Guadalupe Esparza is a prisoner in Texas. By the end of the show, he'll be dead. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where final preparations are underway to execute Esparza by injecting him with massive doses of drugs made to save lives. Over the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will provide live coverage and commentary on the state killing. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, legal analyst Jim Skelton, guest attorneys Susan Ashley and Larry Douglas, Huntsville reporter outside the death house Gloria Rubeck, Houston Vigil reporter Dave Atwood, and special guest Shuja Grant, imprisoned for years on California's death row for a murder he did not commit. He was one of two dozen death row exonerees who led this year's march in Austin against the death penalty. The Execution Watch begins.
And this is Ray Hill, the host of Execution Watch. This program is produced by Elizabeth Stein, and we have a great cast of characters to cover a very grim subject for you tonight. The reason we are here on, and here is, if you're listening on executionwatch.org, on kpft.org, or if you're listening on KPFT HD3 channel, the reason we're here is that Texas has decided to go into the killing business tonight. Every time they do that, we do an Execution Watch show during the actual process of that execution. Tonight, Guadalupe Esparza, 46 years old, is scheduled for execution. He received his execution date some 3 months ago in San Antonio, and the judge who ignored his attorney's request to delay to prepare appeal based on evidence of Esparza's mental retardation and therefore ineligible for execution, the jury ordered Esparza put to death in 2001. As this show progresses, you're going to find out what is going on in Huntsville around the death chamber. You're going to find out what happened in this case. You're going to find out what happened in the trials and the appeals of this case. And by the end of the show, Mr. Esparza will be dead. Do we have Gloria? All right. Gloria? Gloria?
Demanding that the death penalty...
Gloria is double duty. In addition to talking to us, she's also got the megaphone outside of the walls. Gloria.
Elizabeth?
No, it's Ray. You're on the air.
Oh, I'm on the air. Oh, okay. Let me turn this microphone off.
What's going on up there?
Well, we've got a huge crowd of people here. A teacher from a college in Abilene has brought her class, who is studying the death penalty, to Huntsville. How far did y'all drive to get here? 5 hours? Before, I don't know. I know Abilene is like out
forever out there.
West Texas. So yeah. There is the news media has gone in, Ray. The family has just crossed over and gone in. So it appears that the execution is happening. I'm wondering why. You're the professor? Why did you come for this particular execution?
Well,
it just happened.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Okay. This was happened in her classes in session. So,
they just came because it was a convenient date, and it's actually the last execution that's scheduled.
Okay. Anyone other than the class? Anybody from the family? Anybody from the other side there?
If there's people who are pro execution, I don't see them. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 6 of us besides the class who were here.
Okay.
And it's a difficult case because it was a horrible crime that Esparza was accused of, although I believe he was claiming he was innocent. The Supreme Court turned him down on an Atkins claim, I believe. but I don't know.
Okay, Gloria, what's the upcoming schedule for the abolition movement?
Well, our next meeting is on Tuesday, December 6th, but in December, we don't actually have a meeting. We usually get 20, 30, 40 people together and sign holiday cards for the men and women on death row. So that is our next event, December 6th, signing cards, and we'll be at the Shape Center on Live Oak.
The Shape Center on Live Oak as opposed to the one on Alameda. And what time and date is the meeting?
It's Tuesday, Tuesday, December 6th, and we usually gather about 6 o'clock and get the food set up and cards passed out and have a go at it.
Okay, Gloria, keep us...
You're welcome to join us for that.
Keep us posted of what's going on up there.
Okay, I will.
Thank you.
All right, thanks, Ray. Bye-bye.
That was Gloria Ruback of the Abolition Movement, and she and her organization have been... keeping watch and taking care of folks on death row for a long time. We have an interesting, is Dave Atwood ready? Oh, Dave Atwood is ready, all right. Dave, you're on.
Okay, how are you doing?
I am well, where are you?
I'm at the corner of Alameda and Holcomb in Houston, right by where the Dominican Sisters have their place. And we've got, Ray, we've got about 7 people here today.
Okay.
The steady 7 that are always here, and sometimes we grow more than that, but today we get 7, and we're, you know, hundreds, I think really thousands of cars go by while we're out here. It's just amazing.
Yeah, Alameda Street is a commuter distance. Actually, I passed that way on my way to the station. I was
right,
way out.
Right.
I was way out whenever the time came to come here.
Yeah. So, we're doing our thing. We've got our signs and our banners, stop executions. And, again, most of the people that go by us, if they do anything, they give us a thumbs up or they toot their horn in favor of what we're doing. So that's a lot different than what we saw 10 or 15 years ago doing this kind of a thing. And it's always a hopeful sign, I think, to be out here on the corner and actually see the positive response that we get from a lot of people.
Dave Atwood is the founder and major motivator for the Coalition to End the Death Penalty, or Coalition, let's see, is it Coalition?
Yeah, Texas Coalition.
To Abolish the Death
Abolish
Penalty.
Abolish the Death Penalty.
Okay, and Dave, tell us about the organization and how people can get in touch.
Well, you know, we are a statewide organization, so actually there are protests against this execution going on throughout the state of Texas. And our organization we have an office up in Austin, and people can get a hold of us. Best way to go to the website, which is www.tcadp.org. And, you know, all of us are trying to grow this movement. So anybody that hears this, please get involved. You know, one way or the other in this movement, because things are changing in this state, even in the state of Texas. Things are changing. More and more people are against the death penalty, and we will abolish the death penalty in the state of Texas.
Dave, I need to inform you that the word we had from Huntsville just prior to your coming on was that the witnesses had crossed the road.
Oh, okay. That's sad.
I'm going to explain.
Sad news.
I'm going to explain that to our listeners, and we'll talk to you later in the program.
Okay. You take care.
Okay. Bye-bye. Okay, you've heard from Gloria Ruback outside the death chamber in Huntsville, and you've heard from Dave Atworth outside a convent here in Houston to let you know that there is some action going on out in the streets in opposition to this execution. There's always something going on in opposition to execution. When the word is that the witnesses, the media witnesses and the witnesses for the family have crossed the road, that means that the process has begun. It is now 10 minutes after 6 o'clock. Everything began on schedule this time. Sometimes it happens later, never happens earlier. The window for execution in Texas is between 6 p.m. and midnight, but operatively, Texas Department of Criminal Justice says don't give us the word after 11:15. So the window to execute in Texas is from 6 p.m. to 11:15. Larry Douglas is with us in the studio, and he's going to give us the foundational information about this case.
Well, just factually, Ray, Guadalupe Garza, Esparza, I'm sorry, was convicted and given the death penalty for the kidnap and rape and murder of a 7-year-old girl, Alyssa Vasquez, occurring back on June 6th of 1999. The way it happened is the young girl's mother was away from home and the babysitter was next door. And what Esparza did before the little girl showed up missing is he called the house several times, checking to see where the mother was and when she would be returning home. Then around 2:30 a.m., the babysitter noticed that Vasquez, the little girl, was missing, and later on saw Esparza running down the road. Now, he lived only about a mile and a half away from the little girl's house. And about 4:30 in the morning, that's about an hour and a half later, they found him in his house in blood-spattered shirt and boxer shorts in the trash can outside. He reportedly admitted to involvement in the offense by telling a detention guard in the jail and also telling another inmate in the Bexar County Jail of his involvement. And even testified contrary to that. There was also some DNA evidence that was consistent with Esparza. He has a fairly long criminal history that certainly didn't help him out a whole lot. Going back about 20 years, he was about 34 years old when this offense occurred, and from the time he was about 13 or 14 years old to the time he was 34, he had a fairly lengthy criminal history. That didn't help him a whole lot. And trying to represent him, the lawyer who tried to represent him, not only were the facts pretty bad and his criminal history was extremely bad, the other thing that happened is, over his lawyer's strong objection, Esparza decided to testify. And due to his testifying, we have a legal term called opening the door. He opened the door to an alleged offense that occurred about 2 weeks earlier, where he was alleged to have tried to rape another 7-year-old girl. Now, that evidence was supposedly introduced just for the fact of attacking his credibility. And the jury instruction said to consider it only for that reason. But that had to be just really terrible for him. I'm not sure that he would have fared a whole lot better had that evidence not come in. But nonetheless, he did decide to testify over his lawyer's strong objection and ended up getting the death penalty.
Larry, whenever someone, an accused defendant, makes a decision to insist on testifying in the trial, there's no obligation for them to do that. There's usually no expectation that that's going to happen. Isn't that right?
Exactly. I mean, he has the absolute constitutional right not to testify. It's not a constitutional prohibition. It's just the constitutional right not to testify. And typically in a case like this, he would not testify. It was so unusual that even there was a point of error brought because of this. But the judge herself admonished him briefly on the record that, you know, he didn't have to testify, but he insisted on doing so anyway.
He insisted on doing so, and once he gets on the stand, they can ask him virtually any question they want to.
He is subject to cross-examination. It's not just virtually any question, but it does leave him pretty wide open. The thing is, though, when he testified on direct examination, the way he opened the door was he did have a sexual assault conviction that clearly would have been admissible. He testified that, well, that sexual assault conviction was of an adult, never a child, because I'd never do something like that to a child. Mm-hmm. That was an adult woman. Well, that just opened the door to the 7-year-old attempted sexual assault that would not have come in, would not have been admissible had he not done that. But by his doing that, that opened the door for a similar offense to come in, not to prove that the offense actually occurred, but actually to show to attack his credibility as a witness.
Well, did you get any evidence in looking at the record that his attorneys were less than responsible in all of this?
No, I didn't get that
impression. In fact, the impression I got is that his attorneys were highly qualified, and that they had done pretty much as could be done under the circumstances. He would have fared potentially better had he cooperated with them, but had even if he had, I'm not sure that the result would have been any different. But I do think that he fairly sealed his fate.
Well, what do you do? What do you do if you're a lawyer and you're in a case where there's all this sensitive information that you're trying to avoid the jury being exposed to, and your client is headed over the cliff of insisting on doing this? What does it feel like to be that lawyer?
Well, I mean, there's a limit to what you can do, because the rights are the client's right, not the lawyer's rights. So the lawyer does have to advise the client of the risks associated with testifying in this case. Maybe it admonishes the client on the record outside the presence of the jury. Sometimes that's done. Sometimes just a matter of writing a letter to him or writing a memo to him, just letting him know, just to document of what I told you and have him sign it, perhaps. But in the final analysis, the final decision is that made by the client. And so you just have to accept what the client does and then attempt to represent that client to the best of your ability under whatever the circumstances are.
Do you have any idea how long this trial lasted?
I did not get any impression from looking at the record, looking at the appellate court. The case in the appellate court, I didn't get an impression on how long it had lasted. I do know that the appeals, they raised like 20, 23, 24 points of error. But I did not get an impression on how long it lasted. The death penalty case, I guess, used to last a fairly long time. They've become a lot more streamlined in recent years, though.
All right, that was Larry Douglas. Larry is a practicing attorney in Houston, and he represents a broad range of clients, and he is brought in to give us some idea about that. Is Susan available? Susan, what happened after the initial trial?
Well, after Mr. Esparza was convicted, they go into the punishment stage of the trial. At the punishment stage of the trial, the state will introduce all past convictions, and they can also go into bad acts, misconduct, bad conduct, and they can bring on witnesses to testify to that effect. Now, in Mr. Esparza's case, there was a lot to put on. And so what happened is the state put on evidence that Mr. Esparza's history, criminal history, extended 20 years prior. He started 20 years prior before this case. He started at a young age committing crimes and bad acts. Originally, he was a juvenile. He was picked up for arson. This was 1978. He received an informal adjustment through the Bexar County Juvenile Probation Department instead of going to jail. Okay, the following year in, I guess, 1979, he attempted to steal a bicycle at knife point from a child that was younger than himself, a younger child. Shortly thereafter, he was arrested for criminal mischief. That charge was dismissed. In 1980, he was suspended from high school. A former classmate came there and testified that Esparza was a bully, and that he also testified that there was an incident where Esparza broke out the window of his family car with a pipe and threatened to beat him up at school the next day. Another former classmate testified that, and then this was a female, that Esparza strangled and tried to sexually assault her in the woods late one night when she was 13 years old, but she was able to run away. In 1984, Esparza was convicted of assault and causing bodily injury when he hit a man with a metal pipe and a baseball bat. The next year, he was convicted and sentenced to 12 years for committing an aggravated sexual assault. He apparently beat the victim with a loaded gun and forced her to have sex with him. While he was incarcerated, Esparza was described as getting in trouble or infractions all the time while he was incarcerated. And apparently there was an incident where Esparza and other inmates attacked another inmate, a group. He was part of a group of men that attacked an inmate, and apparently if prison officials, you know, guards had not interceded, they felt that this man they attacked would have been killed. Let's see. He was paroled for his aggravated sexual assault case. While he was on parole, he was paroled out in 1996. No, wait a minute. That's the second case. I'm sorry. I'm on a prior case. He was convicted of the aggravated sexual assault in 1985. He paroled out, and he, in 1992, he was apparently arrested for stealing a car and apparently conspired to steal the wheels off another car. Later in May of 1993, he pled guilty to possession of cocaine, and he received an 8-year sentence. He paroled out in 1996 on the 8-year sentence for cocaine, and then he was put into a mandatory sex offender treatment program. He apparently completed that program. However, he tried to sexually assault a child shortly before this case. It was 2 weeks before he assaulted, or shall we say raped and murdered, this child that he's being executed for. The other incident was 2 weeks before. And that would all, it's fair, basically the state has entitled to put that on it, punishment. Some of the things, perhaps it would have been, shall we say, Esparza could not help himself by testifying at guilt or innocence. However, the evidence at guilt or innocence would have still resulted in a conviction.
It would have come out
because there was DNA evidence.
Yeah.
Okay, there was DNA evidence that there was more than DNA evidence. A neighbor, the babysitter, apparently saw Esparza running down the street. Police went to his residence, and they saw the bloody clothes, you know, in a trash can outside his house. It was his bloody clothes. And then later there was DNA evidence that conclusively, you know, linked him to the victim. And he apparently admitted the crime to, I believe, another inmate, to a detention guard and another inmate. So even without him testifying, you can virtually say it was certain he would be convicted. And then the punishment stage would just be the state had a lot to work with, and they just unloaded all the prior convictions. And apparently, he was a bully, and
now,
people came down there to testify
against him. In the trial dealing with guilt and innocent portion of the trial, his testifying meant that some of the evidence came out that was pretty serious about this attempted earlier event. That would have come out anyway.
It would have come out anyway.
In the punishment
phase. Right, right.
Once the guilt or innocence has been determined. So all he did is he gave the jury an early peek at all of this.
Right.
And it's from what has been presented here, the jury didn't have a hard time wrestling with the evidence in this case.
There might be completely other types of cases. I'm not a case like Esparza's. There may be cases where at guilt or innocence, for, say, certain strategic reasons, a lawyer may want the defendant to let the jury know they have past convictions for different things, assuming they'll be convicted, and then the jury won't be shocked at the punishment phase.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the jury may be more sympathetic
thing.
That the man is saying, yes, I was, say, convicted of drugs before, shall we say, to take away the state's thunder at punishment. However, that would not apply in this case, and it really wouldn't make any difference if whether Garza, he was going to get convicted anyway.
Okay, is Jim going to take up the appellate end of all of this?
You got to answer when you're
okay, that question. Was Susan Ashley. She, too, is a practicing attorney, and she has covered the second half of a two-part trial. One is guilt or innocent. The other part is the punishment. And now we've got the appellate phase. And, Jim, every case, every capital case, has a specific appellate procedure they go through, right?
Right. In answer to your question, the whole trial lasted about 9 days, about 2 weeks, counting, you know, weekends off. And part of that was a punishment phase. Part of it was guilt or innocence. The whole trial is about 9 pages long, or about 9 days long. And when you look at trying to figure out the facts in these cases, you basically have about 4 different records you look at. And what's notable about the appeal is what wasn't done as opposed to what was done. For example, we don't have access when we do the show to the trial record because we do not know what went on at the trial because that trial record is not available except at the clerk's office, mm-hmm. and it's very voluminous. You can imagine trying to read a sure. week, 2 weeks of trial. The first thing you look at is when you look at these opinions is the appeal that's gone from the trial court to the Court of Criminal Appeals. That's called a direct appeal. What's interesting about this case, and it's been pretty typical of most of them, whenever a court issues an opinion, they either decide to publish it or not publish it. If they don't publish it, that means it's not precedent and it's not put in the law book. It has applicability only to the facts of this case. You can't even refer to it in the future as being precedent. This case was non-published. That when they affirmed his conviction, it was non-published. As a result of that, it's very hard to find that opinion, to find out the details, because it's a non-published opinion back in 2003.
Jim, I'm going to interrupt you
sure,
there.
No
we're
problem.
Going to get this because we've got a report, I gather, from Huntsville. Gloria?
Yes.
What's going on?
Well, the 477th person has been executed. His family has come out of the death house along with the media. And, you know, it's really frightening that Texas is getting close to 500 executions now. It's pretty appalling, actually.
And this is 500 executions since they began executing in what, 1976?
You know, I wish I knew how to use this smartphone I've got in my hand.
Okay.
I was going to put...
That's why they call it smart, Lori. It's more intelligent than we are, so...
Yeah, I've had it a week now, and I haven't quite figured it out. There's a... What's the name of y'all's college? Say it again? Hardin-Simmons University.
Hardin-Simmons University, indeed.
And there's, I don't know, 15? How many do you have? 15 here, and... It's a combined political science and criminal justice class on the death penalty.
Okay.
And I'm assuming this... Is this the first time y'all have ever been in Huntsville?
I came as a child, but I didn't.
Yeah. So this is the first time they've ever been here for an execution. Their professor was brave and brought them down here. So there's quite a lot of discussions going on here, but there's a couple of students that are actually willing to go on the air. I don't know what your schedule is.
Well, we can take someone briefly if you want to put them on.
Okay. Yeah,
hand them your phone.
No. You said that you would speak on the air? Okay. I'm going to turn you over to the host of the show, whose name is Ray. And Ray, here she goes.
Yeah, you're on live.
And
hello,
and what is your name?
Kristen McNulty.
Kristen, and you are a student at Hardin-Simmons?
Yes, sir.
And what are you studying there?
Criminal justice.
Is that your major?
Yes, sir.
All right, so this is a major studies excursion for you. Did standing outside the death house, did you learn anything in this process other than it's a long way from Hardin-Simmons to Huntsville?
It's surreal. I mean, we talk about it in books all day, every day, about, you know, Texas executes more prisoners and inmates than any other state in the United States. And just stand outside and just chit-chat and just have friendly arguments among our classmates and stuff of who's against it and who's, you know, for it. It's just surreal to know that somebody is inside getting executed.
Back in the classroom, is there a pretty free exchange of ideas about death penalty and justifications for and against?
Absolutely. I mean, we have a kind of a split majority in our class, kind of probably about half and half, but our professor is very open about what our opinions are. She never by any means leans one way or the other, and actually most of us don't even know her opinion. I don't think any of us know her opinion on the death penalty, and so it's just very open discussion, open class.
That sounds like a good academic exercise then. Mm-hmm. Are you, what do you plan to do with this education?
I want to be in law enforcement. I'm actually applying right now for a police officer. I graduate in a month, so.
You graduate in a month, and you're going to go into direct law enforcement. What are your ultimate career goals?
Maybe one day work for DEA. That's definitely an option. course, once I get more into a department, that may change.
Of course, there's a lot of money over in that territory. As a matter of fact, well, I think we had three indicted in Houston last week because of the lure of the money. So you want to be careful when you get over there.
Mm-hmm. It's definitely just a goal right now. One day I would love to be in the Senate. I mean, of course, that's just that's a minor goal that I have as a student, and where that may go 10 years, 15 years down the road, I have no idea. But my short-time goal for now is to become a police officer.
All right. We wish you well. And when you get to Austin and in that Senate office, I'll probably be banging on your door because I go up there and wet those people's pant legs pretty regularly.
Well, I look forward to it.
Thank you, ma'am. Bye-bye.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
And that was a student from Hardin-Simmons down to do that. And that's an interesting career. Let's go back to Jim. Okay, so Jim, in the direct appeal, did anything happen?
Nothing. Because what happened when they decide not to publish what they're basically saying when we're not publishing opinion, there's nothing of any legal merit in the brief. There's nothing unique. There's nothing different. There's nothing new to be added to the body of law. Therefore, we're not going to publish it. And so there's really nothing on the direct appeal that was published. And the next thing that happens, the next thing you look at after the direct appeal, there's a post-conviction writ filed in state court, and it goes to the Court of Criminal Appeals. And that, they did, they had a non-published opinion, and I pulled that non-published opinion on the writ, and all they said in that opinion was he had 20-something points of error. The trial judge gave an evidentiary hearing. The trial judge decided and recommended that we do not get him relief, and we adopt the trial judge's findings. They didn't even bother to say what his points on appeal were. It's kind of one of those wham-bam, thank-you-ma'am things. So there was nothing in that record on the state writ. Then afterwards, the next procedure is filing a writ in federal district court, and then from there going to the Fifth Circuit. Sometimes the federal district court will publish their hearings when they have those writ hearings. They didn't publish one in this one. It went to the Fifth Circuit, and the Fifth Circuit affirmed the denial of the writ and did it in an unpublished opinion.
Is this one of those cases which you famously say not a lot of trees died in
no
this process?
No trees died.
No trees died.
What
in this
I
process.
Think, when you think about this case, Ray, when you look at the facts of it, you can kind of read between the lines. It's really one of two things. This kid had either a real bad background, like a penury background, because normally when a kid starts setting fires at the age of 14, that indicates some type of anger, obvious, and some type of mistreatment on the part of the family. Or it could be one of those rare examples, and we have those, we must admit it. There are some people that are just born that are bad. In fact, John Steinbeck, when he wrote the book East of Eden, theorized that. We all accept the fact that physically people are born handicapped. They may be born without an arm, without a limb. By the same token, there are some people born where parts of their brains don't work.
All right, we're going to get back to Jim on genetics and other wonderful topics in a few minutes. But right now,
John Steinbeck,
and which is always a worthy cause. Right now, we're going to go to Shuja. Shuja.
Hello.
Are you there, Shuja?
Yes, speaking.
Okay, Shuja Graham is an exoneree who was recently in Texas. Where are you now, Shuja?
I'm at home in Maryland, Tacoma Park, and trying to recuperate from the long but really exciting time that I had in Texas over the last 2 weeks.
Well, you met a lot of other exonerees, and did Texans treat you hospitably?
We had a wonderful time. We was driven around by Delia Perez and Umar, who's a part of Witness Anderson, and we went out to many different cities in Texas. I think we was able to reach a lot of peoples, and that was heartwarming. And in the end, coming to the march in Austin was a great moment for me myself, because I've been coming to Texas for a long time.
Shuja, I want to clear something up, a question a lot of people have on their mind. I've kind of discussed it in the clinches with others. You're an exoneree. You were sent to death row for something you did not do. How strongly do you feel about execution for people who did it?
I had this discussion when I was on death row. I'm not just a death row survivor. I'm also a murder victim family member. My mother, brother, who became a police officer in Lake Providence, Louisiana, where I was where I grew up at, and he raised me as a young boy before I left there. While I was on death row, he was killed as a police officer. So I get it from both sides, and it's no matter what a person's situation is, I'm against the death penalty in all forms.
Well, that...
The conversation that I had with people on death row when I was there at San Quentin, a lot of the people who was guilty say, Suja, I'm guilty. I deserve to die because of the awful thing that I've done. But my thing was always, no matter what you've done, the state has a responsibility to protect society. I think the state can protect society without resorting to killing, because it only create more victims. Like, for example, my mother, she lost many people in her family, and I lost people in my family to violence. And I can never, one moment when my mother or my uncle or my grandmother talked about the death penalty as a solution to making her or him feel better.
Well, you know, frequently...
The death penalty in all situations. And if someone has got a good case of innocence, then it's my responsibility as an activist, not just an exoneree, but as an activist, to try to prove that person innocent. Then if a person's guilty, then I'm going to fight to keep that person from being executed. The state has a responsibility to protect society. Like Tookie Williams once said before he was executed, what's the difference between a state and a person that kills? And the predetermined outcome is orchestrated death. When someone robbed, do we enact robbery against the robber as a form of punishment? Of course not. So why, when someone kills, we have to kill to prove that killing is wrong? And I think the solution to our problem in society is to continue to educate and educate people about capital punishment.
Shuja, it's an old chestnut for people to look at me whenever I speak out against executions and say, well, it never happened to you. Well, actually, it did. I have lost two people very close to me to homicides. One of them was killed by a burglar. The other was assassinated by a police officer. I would not want either of those people to have been executed. And so the old chestnut that it is my position against execution is only because it hasn't happened to me does not hold up. And you're an excellent example of a person who's seen both sides of that valley. Hello?
Yes, most definitely. I've seen sides of the ball field, as you may want to call it, and it took a lot of work for me myself. I remember when I was released from prison and after spending 11 years in prison and three of them on California's death row, remember when I initially got out and I was like an angry person. I had a lot of anger and me being political for a lot of good people who surrounded me and constantly encouraging me that I was, then I can out and fight and bless people that get out so that you can do the things necessary to make sure what happened to you never happened to anyone else.
Shuja,
our founding, our group, Witness to Innocence, I think we're one of the most powerful group potentially in the United States in terms of capital punishment.
Shuja, most other people have an option of whether or not to be political. Folks that have done time, you on death row, me in general population in a prison, really don't have much choice. It's our lot in life to take these issues to a political level in hopes that solution may someday be found. Any comment?
I'm kind of having a hard time hearing you because I'm getting some feedback.
Okay, well, listen, we appreciate your calling on. We wish you well. The next time you come to Texas, give us a heads up and we'll coffee up.
Okay, and thanks for everything, and continue to do the good work that you're doing, and through education, I'm sure in time, much sooner than we think, capital punishment will not only be eliminated in America, but in Texas sooner than we think.
Thank you.
Long live the spirit of those who fight in Texas, and thank you for your support.
Thank you, Shuja. And that was a man who is, knows where he's coming from. He's exonerated from death row in California prison system, and came from Louisiana before that. So that's an interesting twist. Jim, so there are the theory of the bad seed.
Yeah, let me give you a couple examples of it. There's, like Steinbeck had talked about it in the book East of Eden, and there's a real interesting book called Mother's Request, in which a woman in Utah, later lived in New York, had her son to kill her own father, and did it primarily because she's going to be disinherited. And what was interesting when I read the book, I've had maybe about five or six clients that would fit in this category. And what's interesting about that bad seed concept is they're bad from the very beginning. For example, when she was an infant crying, everything had to be her way. She was a problem infant, a problem child, a problem everybody. And she never was anything but a problem. And it was at the very beginning, and I don't care if she'd been raised by a bevy of nuns in the Vatican, she'd have been a problem. And there was nothing going to change that. I've had several clients, maybe about five or six, that fit in that category. And what's real interesting, and this is why I thought it was interesting what Larry had to say, what's real interesting, there's a theory kicking around that those that have that bad seed take every step they can to make sure they're going to be convicted and killed. And they do real stupid things to make sure they're going to be convicted. Like in this case, he would probably have gotten convicted anyway. And as I told Larry earlier, the two worst things about this case were the facts and him testifying, because he basically put himself in the death penalty. If the facts didn't do it, he made damn sure that he would do it.
Well, what about the theory of people committing suicide with the state's needle?
I think there's such a thing as committing suicide by cops, but suicide by needle, I think that's one. The concept is basically this. Like a child with a bad mental handicap will oftentimes have a physical handicap that guarantee that that won't live, that gene will die out quickly. And that's the theory that's been kicking around about the bad seed, is that these people do everything possible. It seems like when you... Let me give you an example. I can do it better by illustration. Remember Dudley Bell years ago, the investigator here in Houston? He's dead now, died of cancer. I defended Dudley on a case. And Dudley literally, in this particular case, he was involved in some wiretapping and a bunch of crazy stuff. He created a tape recording of him breaking into a place along with the client. He made the tape recording. Then he saved the tape recording, put it in the back of his car so the police could find it. Now, not only that, I'm not finished. When they played the tape recording in court, it's hard to identify who was on the tape. So my defense was going to be they couldn't identify his voice. Now, Dudley insisted that we call a character witness by the name of Schulte. Remember that cop that was out there in Jersey?
Yeah, I remember Schulte.
Now, he had a horrible reputation. We had a knockdown, drag-out fight. I didn't want to call Schulte to testify. Dudley insisted that I do it. So we were the ones that called him. So we called Schulte as a witness on Friday. On Monday, he appeared for the government and said, I've heard the tape, and that's Dudley's voice on tape. So Dudley not only produced the tape that convicted him, he saved that tape so the police could find it. Then he provided the witness who identified his voice on it. And you couldn't have planned. I mean, I told him later, I said, Dudley, you think about this. When you go to prison over this case, remember, you set the crime up. Number two, you tape recorded it. Number three, you saved the tape recording. And to make damn certain you get convicted, you provided the witness that identified your voice on the tape. I want you to think about that. And Theodore Bundy's another classic example. He did everything possible in his trial to make sure he'd get the death penalty. For example, when Bundy killed the girls in Tallahassee, the worst thing was the crime scene, because he had beat them to death, and there was brain particles on the ceiling, and he had bit one girl on the buttocks. And that's when they did that teeth matching.
Oh, yeah, I remember the teeth.
They had a giant photograph of him with his lips spread back, with his teeth looked like a wild animal. They blew it up. He insisted on cross-examining the police officer who made the scene. And he stood in front of that photograph. The jury looked at him in that photograph and went through step by step every bit of the brain matter, everything, all the gory details of the crime scene. I mean, only a fool would have done that. I mean, the facts might have convicted him, but believe me, his participation.
The drama.
The drama. The same thing in this case. Now, Larry's right. They might very well have given him the death penalty had he not testified. But by him testifying, he made certain he's going to get the death penalty. So this has the earmarks of that classic case of those people like Dudley. He would do these. He would get in trouble. They're never going to stay out of trouble. There is no way in the world. There's no law, moral or man-made. They haven't broken or would feel any problems with breaking. But by the same token, it is amazing when you defend these people in court. Bob Colson's another example. I defended him. He was the one that killed his entire adopted family, mm-hmm. including his sister, killed five people on Halloween. Killed all of them. And what makes this a particular gruesome death? Strangulation. When you strangle somebody, I've represented a number of people who strangle folks, and most of them have nightmares afterwards because strangling isn't like they show in Hollywood where you die. It takes about 8 to 15 minutes for someone to die when you're strangling them. During that process, they turn blue, they gag, they gasp. It's like a fish out of water. It's a really gory way to kill somebody because you're right up to, against them. You're right next to them, and you see all of that. And by strangling this little girl, it wasn't one of those five-minute episodes. It had to last over a period of almost 10 minutes. And he had to be in close proximity to her. And then for him to testify about, you know, like I say, it's one of those things when you look at this case, you get the first impression he's one of those bad seeds that I don't care what you would have done, that he's going to be in trouble. And those are rare, unique. I remember one time I defended a guy here in Houston who broke into the Catholic bishop at the diocese here in town over in Wynn Westview. Mm-hmm. He tried to pull the Catholic priest's eye out and went home and told his sister, "I almost brought you home an eye." After that, they went over to Bel Air and robbed some old lady who was babysitting some children, got their piggy bank, broke it open. There was like a 9-year-old girl there. He took his hand in her vagina and tried to rip her apart.
Oh, Jesus.
And I sent him to a psychiatrist, Eliezer Bell, and the psychiatrist called me up and said, "Jim, he's not crazy. He's damn mean, period." And what was funny, he had came from a real good family. He had an excellent family from Louisiana. Everybody in the family, there's no broken home, no evidence of childhood abuse. From the very beginning of his life, this kid was mean and horrible. For example, he had cancer when he was 7 years old, and they had to amputate a leg. He was convinced his family hated him, cut his leg off because they despised him. And he's the only person I've ever met you could walk into a room and his eyes would literally grow with hatred. He would just whenever they mix that genetic pool up in him, they didn't get the genes right. And there are people like that walking among us, but they're rare and unusual.
Jim, a kid losing a leg's pretty traumatic experience.
Yeah, but you don't think you're going to accuse your family of cutting it off because they don't like you. I mean, that's a kind of an extreme, because cutting a leg is real traumatic.
I know. Trust me, I know about
you got,
that. Right.
You're working on it. You haven't got quite there yet. We got the foot down. But I understand, Ray. But I'm saying that I understand that, but this kid was convinced that his family hated him and did it for spite. You don't think you lost your foot because someone's
The wonderful thing about doing this radio show with Jim Skelton Room is he got such a wealthy reservoir of experience to bring and share, and he can describe that with a great deal of colorfulness. But that brings me back to the very serious matter that Guadalupe Esparza died.
Yes.
And if he had family witnesses there, so what happened after he is dead, after the state has put needles in him and put poison in his body and watched very ritualistically and carefully while he drew his last breath, and then someone come in and did a check of him and assured everybody in the room that he was dead, then Carnes Funeral Home has an employee in there. And he puts him on a gurney, and they carry the body out. And it goes to a local Baptist church, a little Baptist church, not a big church, but a little church. And the body awaits the family coming to visit the body while it is still warm. I know this is really morbid, but Jim's descriptions of some of his former clients and our analysis of today's case tends to be a little morbid. Doing the Execution Watch show is not pleasant work, and sometimes we deal with realities that make us all a little bit uncomfortable. I think that Shuja got it right. It really doesn't make any difference to him, an innocent person who survived death row, whether a person is guilty or innocent. If they're innocent, they certainly need to be discovered to be innocent and exonerated and released like him. And like him, then they dance with the demons of the memories of being on death row, which pretty clearly comes across in today's program. You're listening to today's program, and I appreciate you going to the trouble to do that, because we're not on the broadcast channel tonight. We're on HD3, and so most of you are listening to it over the Internet, and that is the nature of how we can deliver this program with reliability. KPFT is past its fundraising period, but Pacifica Archives is fundraising on the broadcast channels of all five Pacifica stations tonight. And why that is important to you is this program will live forever, not only on executionwatch.org's archive, where we still have an archive of every show we ever did, but all of our material is also archived at the Pacifica National Archive. So 50 years from now, someone will go to that archive and pull the memory of the execution of Guadalupe Esparza. And they will listen to what we've had to say here today, and I hope it makes no sense to them at all. I hope by then, 50 years from now, we're in a post-execution era. And when we get there and we look back, we need to remember what happened here, lest some future generation decide they're going to make the same damn fool mistake again. A fellow by the name of Peterson, who was the institutional director of Texas Department of Criminal Justice, Peterson and I fought like cats and dogs over a period of time. I mean, we could not walk into a room without shouting one another. And then when each of us had defended our turf with some kind of macho satisfaction, that's a kind of a male game that we played, and then when we got through doing that, then what we would do then is sit down and talk about maintaining the archive. And the archive is that part of Texas prison history where we remember what we have been doing for 150 years in Texas prisons. And it's all there. And he wanted to maintain it, and I wanted to maintain it for exactly the same reason. If sanity comes, and we don't lock people up for the extremely long sentences we do in Texas, if sanity comes and we're able to handle people's wrongdoings with the kind of sophistication that a mature society can, if we can change that system, let's not forget what we did when we did it wrong. My name is Ray Hill, and you've been listening to Execution Watch here on radio station KPFT Houston HD2 channel. And I can tell that I have got about five more minutes left in this show. Larry, Susan, Jim, anything else?
I want to add one thing, Ray. Sure. We're talking about the bad seed. See, it seems to be worse to execute somebody with the bad seed because, number one, they didn't ask to be born that way. And I think that's just like executing a guy because he's born with red hair. And I think that's the worst sort of execution. Not that what they did is admirable, because it's not admirable.
It's not.
But they didn't ask to be born with that genetic makeup. And to me, that's a horrible thing, because they didn't ask to feel this way. I remember talking to a pedophile one time. He said, "Jim, I don't want to feel this way. I wish I could change this. I feel horrible about myself. I didn't ask to be born this way." And I think it's horrible, and assuming we have these bad seeds, executing them seems to be cruel because nature did that to them. They didn't have that choice, and they can't help it because they don't have emotions and feelings like the rest of us. That's the way they were born. And I think that's even more egregious because they don't ever have a shot. And like the old thing they said about Sonny Liston, he died the day he was born. And that might have been happened with this kid here. He might have very well have died the day he was born, because either he was he was one of those bad seed kids that didn't have a choice, or he'd been abused as a child, has all the earmarks of that. And either one of them, it's bad to execute. So it's something they have no control over. We're killing them.
Well, Jim, having said that, does the fact of execution say more about who we are than who they are?
Yes, absolutely. Because that's like. Remember years ago, A.E. Housman, back, he was a gay man. Back in those days, A.E. Housman could not talk about gays. When Oscar Wilde was being tried, mm-hmm. he wrote a poem, "They're Killing a Man Because He Was Born with Red Hair." And what he's using that as an analogy, that Oscar Wilde was born gay. He didn't choose his life. That's the way he was made up. Why would you condemn somebody who's acting in accordance to the nature that was given to him by a being, by nature? Call it what you want to. And that's what we've done in cases where we execute the bad seed. That's because they have no choice over their conduct.
They just don't have a movement to get their act together and defend. Or maybe being political would somehow change them.
Well, I don't think they should be able to, because the trouble is they never do adjust to society real well. We've got to figure out some way to isolate them from society but not kill them. Because like I say, that to me is the cruelest thing, because they have no choice. They're acting according to what genetic makeup they were given they had no control over. And to me, that's what makes a death penalty especially egregious in this particular case. Not that his conduct doesn't deserve it. I'm not saying that. But it could very well have been he had no choice.
But you and I both know people that are relatively nice people who wound up getting executed too.
Right.
Not because, I mean, the Billy Hugheses of this world who ran businesses and had good Billy's far better organized than I was, and he did all that from death row, and they killed him.
Remember the guys involved in that prison escape when he'd been gone to penitentiary?
We've got three of those coming up.
Remember, one of the guys said, "I deserve to die. I'm not mm-hmm. going to argue about it. What I did was wrong. I knew when I escaped it was a wrong thing to do, and I have no..." Remember, he was one of those sort of good guys, probably would never do it again. But someone like this kid here, I don't think there's ever a way he would never have behaved himself in prison.
But he would have had something in his makeup to lay the track,
right,
that he followed.
Right.
What you've heard tonight is that Guadalupe Esparza laid the track to his own execution.
Absolutely. And it could have been laid by what he was given at birth, that he had no choice over to. That track could have been laid by Mother Nature as opposed to his conduct.
Well, we've certainly given you something to think about today, but I want to remind you that our show is produced by Elizabeth Ann Stein, and she conceptualized this program and asked me to come help her do it, and I appreciate that invitation. I've enjoyed doing it. Would not be possible to do this without the technical wizardry of Otis McClay. Doyle Odom is our engineer tonight. Our theme song is sung by Victoria Panetti. I want to thank Jim Skelton. I want to thank Susan Ashley, Larry Douglas, and the surprising voice of Suja Graham, all the way from Maryland. Gloria Ruback was our reporter before the death row. David Atwood was our reporter at the demonstration here in Houston, not at the convent. My name is Ray Hill. Thank you for listening. We'll be back the next time they kill somebody.